Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today I have the pleasure of welcoming Justine Hamilton back on my podcast again. Today we're concluding a series of three interviews. Two of them I talked about the lies that I learned to tell myself, and now Justine has decided she has the courage to talk about the lies that she believes that she has told herself.
Dr. Dana Saperstein and the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.
Now, the reason this episode came about is because my daughter, who is the editor and producer of the podcast, said, well, wait a minute, how does Justine get off so easily only talking to you about your lies and not telling us hers? And I said, okay, well, I'll ask Justine. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Justine. I appreciate you coming in to talk about this topic, because I think it actually is really important.
I agree. And anyone who knows me knows that I love to ask the questions. I don't always love the questions coming back to me.
Exactly.
I was driving over here and I was like, you know, I'm kind of excited about this. And then I was like, no, is that just a lie I'm telling myself?
So the first lie is how excited you are about talking about the lies you tell yourself. Oh, that's good. I like that. Might as well start off with a lie.
No, I'm happy to be here.
Good. So how do you want to start talking about this topic? I'm imagining you put some thought into it.
Well, it's interesting because when you asked me to do the podcast, my first reaction was no, because I'm going to ask you the questions. I don't want you to ask me the questions. And then I was like, okay, well, yeah, I will, but let me think about the lies that I've told myself. And I really couldn't, what I had to do is I had to sit down and kind of write them out. Okay. And then the floodgates opened. It's really interesting that, you know, there are lies that I've been telling myself. And even though you kind of know in the back of your mind, there's a little hint like, that feels a little odd, or that's the reason I'm doing a certain behavior. They came out, and I definitely have been, you know, living with some lies my whole life and have gotten better acquainted with some of them through therapy and through work. And I think that that's really meaningful. But these lies, I think, can start pretty early.
Okay.
And,
do you have one that starts off as the earliest one you remember telling yourself?
I think probably one of like the major ones that I have is, and I think actually a lot of women have it, but I think maybe because of the way I was brought up and how I was raised, is that I have to take care of everything.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, my whole life, I've overmanaged, I've overscheduled, haven't trusted others, and I've really spent a lot of time just making sure that everything was done because I had to take care of it. Because when I was growing up, I really did have to rely on myself, and no one was really taking care of me. And that was pretty much out of the gates, and I know that's where that came from.
Sure.
And so that's really been instilled in me for a long time. And I would say it's probably been in the last few years where I was just like, no, I don't have to take care of all of it. Someone else is going to do it. They're just as good as I am. I don't have to look over their shoulders. And again, this is something that I'm still working on, but I'm very well aware of where this came from and how it started. And it's no surprise.
Was it overt in terms of, you know, your family members telling you to take care of yourself, or did they just abandon you and had to take
over? They just abandoned me, Dana.
just checking.
Yeah. No, I grew up I lived with my mom, a single mom until I was 11. She was really negligent. She was young, which is another lie that I told myself, that just because she was young, it was okay. that she was a bad mother, but that's a lie. She was pretty negligent. And so my brother and my sister and I literally just did whatever we wanted because she was never there, never around, didn't really care. And I had a younger sister who was, she was, you know, a baby. She was 2 to 5 at this point in my life. And, you know, I had to make sure she had food. I had to make sure she got to school. I, you know, really took care of her.
And how much older than her were you?
So I was, I think I'm 8 years older than her, maybe. So I was 8, 9, 10, 11. She was 2.
So you became
a
mom as a 9-year-old?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah. I mean, the caveat that really saved me, and I think saved my whole family and my siblings at least, is I had a really involved grandmother and great grandmother.
Oh, okay.
And they made sure we didn't completely go off the rails or had, you know, food in the cupboard or just made sure that we were kind of okay.
And this was your mom's mother and grandmother.
Yeah. Who were like the loveliest people, the loveliest people. And then, you know, but my mom just had she literally had 3 kids by the time she was 23, I think.
Wow.
2 different dads. And she was just a party girl. She was just, she's going out with her friends. She was a waitress. She was out at night. She was never home. She was leaving us with really, you know, questionable babysitters.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I really had to just take care of everything because she was nowhere around. And at that point, my dad, who sort of lived on the other side of town, we were living in like government housing. My dad, who was living in like the nice suburbs, and he had his own family. We would see him on the weekends. And, you know, he had his own life and his own small family and his own wife. And so he was, you know, and he wasn't really emotionally involved or available and was doing the best that he could for what he could, how he could do it. But it was just, you know, we were just left kind of on our own. And wow. So, yeah, I had to take care of it. And so that was probably the number one factor that has really driven my life. And, you know, when I was in my 30s and whatever, I was like, well, that's all good because it made me, you know, super successful at work. And, you know, I take care of stuff and I don't make sure that, you know, nothing happens to me, which all sounds great until you peel back the layers. And it's like, no, like I was sad and I was lonely and it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I, you know, it's nice to be loved and needed by someone else and to be able to give that back to them and not feel like you're just doing it because you have to take care of it.
And when you were a kid, do you remember feeling the anxiety of what would have happened to the people that you loved, the kids, you know, your younger sister, that sort of thing?
I don't really remember feeling that. I think just, again, having my grandmother and my great-grandmother in my back pocket, knowing we weren't totally going to collapse, gave me some comfort. And I loved my baby sister, you know? So it wasn't like it was a burden for me. It was she's my little doll. We're going to, you know, run across the street and get French fries for dinner for 50 cents. And then I'm going to run back and make sure she doesn't get hit by a car. And, you know,
right.
We'd get on the bus and go to church. And because that's how we could, like, you know, eat cookies and drink orange juice on a Sunday morning. And those are just, you know, I just did it.
So when you became aware of the fact that you became a mom, an adult, way before you should have. Have you been able to heal those wounds, do you think?
Yes, because, well, who knows? I think so.
Okay.
But I through work, but I think it really kind of put the perspective in front of me, like, now that I have my own kids, like, how could a mother do that?
Right.
And I don't think you really understand that until you have your own in front of you and you're just like, wait, this was wrong. This was not right. And so as soon as you stop sort of defending their behavior because it makes no sense to you as a mother now, then you can start to heal those wounds. And I think that the lie, you know, the other lie that I would always told myself, and this was, you know, again, for a while later, is that they were young. They were young. They, you know, they had a bunch of kids. And I, you know, I'd be like, well, God, I can't imagine when I was 18 having those kids. I don't know how they did it. And so I gave them, my mom and dad, a pass. But you know what? That wasn't my fault that they that they like didn't use birth control and had children at 18 and 20 while they were children and irresponsible.
Right.
And so I, you know, I stopped just being so lenient about like, well, they were just young and they were fun. But like, no, this was your responsibility. Like, you brought me into this world. And I don't harbor any ill feelings towards them. My dad and I are actually pretty close. And my dad, he had his own crazy upbringing and he was doing the best that he could. And I completely understand that. But it's also just getting, wrapping your head around like, but this isn't okay. And it's not just because you were young. It's like you had no business doing this and you did it. So somehow you need to figure this out. And my mom, when I was just graduating college, my mom was diagnosed with emphysema and she was 40, super young to be like terminally ill. And I spent probably, you know, until she died, like 16 years later with two lung transplants built in there between those, between 40 and 56 of her years. I took a lot of care of her, just making sure that she lived the best life that she could in those 16 years. And I think that was obviously not a nice thing that she died, but it gave me a lot of love and comfort towards her because I knew that she wasn't going to be around forever.
Oh, okay.
And so I, you know, you can't really be mad at someone who's dying. I mean, I guess that you can, but it didn't feel right. And I don't think I really understood how wrong it was until after the fact.
Oh, okay.
So when she was, you know, dying and I'm, you know, I was really taking care of her again because that was just my role. It didn't really bother me. And I just felt like it was the least I could do for someone who wasn't going to be here forever.
Okay.
So that kind of worked out in her favor, I guess. And then it was after the fact that I really was like, no, that you, this was not cool what you did. You know, she just negligent.
So how does it work in your family that you created with your husband now?
I just can't even understand how someone could do that to their children. And I mean, my kids are everything to me. And I just don't even understand it. Right. And so I just make sure that I am really there for them and they know that they are so loved and so seen and so supported. And that's all kids ever want. And so I laid that foundation pretty early and probably healed some of my own wounds in doing so. But that is, you know, my family is my number one priority.
Right. And I know your kids and I know how much they adore you as a mom because they've said so, especially your son. He just feels really connected to you.
Yeah.
Super important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's my journey here and my role of what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, I think that you've transcended where you come from as far as that goes because
thank God.
Think about how absent your mother was and how present you are.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you're working on or have worked on overcoming that lie because you're doing it in a healthy way now.
Yeah. But it didn't come just, you know, you get older and things start to make sense and you question stuff, but it took work and it took time and it took therapy. And if you would have told me, I don't know, you know, 25 years ago that I needed to do some healing, I'd have been like, what? I'm fine. I'm taking care of myself just like every time, but you know, it's good. And it's the most important thing. Another lie that I told myself, and this is, you know, this is funny because it's so opposite of what my my husband believes, not entirely, but I was raised in the Midwest and, you know, a pretty austere household. I wouldn't say there was, excuse me, a lot of joy going on in there. There was just a lot of perfunctory, like, let's get stuff done. And so I was raised to really believe that hard work was all that mattered. You know, you worked hard and you showed up and it was just a very stoic mentality. And that, you know, again, that did great when I was in Los Angeles and building my career. And, you know, I did whatever I could to get to the top because I thought I just needed to work harder than everyone else. And that, you know, that's something also that our society sort of implies. But the reality is, like, there is so much more to life than hard work. I mean, I kind of learned this lesson a little bit later in life where, you know, I just spent so much time just working really hard and not enjoying all that life has to offer.
What was the purpose of hard work? Do you know?
That's just what you did. That, you know, I mean, I think it's probably rooted in religion a little bit. Okay. You know, you get up and you go to the fields and you do whatever and you don't complain and, you know, you just keep moving forward.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's really how it was in my household is like we worked hard and not, you know, we weren't in the fields, but, you know, I had two jobs in high school and I, you know, worked all the time in the summer. And I just, when I, you know, was first in my career in Los Angeles, I'm like, okay, I'm going to get in before everyone. I'm going to be the last one to leave. And, you know, in retrospect, yeah. Did I do a little bit better than everyone else? Yeah. But you know what? So what?
Like, yeah.
Life is not just about showing up to the office right. and, you know, putting your nose to the grindstone. Life is meant to be enjoyed. And that was not what was going on in my religious sort of German, English, Midwest household.
So how did you switch over to a more balanced life?
My husband, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember on our wedding vows that we had to write, I said something about him bringing light into my life.
Oh, okay.
And I think it really was a lot of him where, you know, I burned out. Like I would, living in LA, I mean, I had a, you know, on paper, an incredible position and I was at the top and I made a lot of money. But I would drive home from work some days and just be crying because I was just like, I didn't like it. I was over it. I couldn't leave because we were going to sell the company and it was tough. And then I finally financially was like, okay, I can take a break. I can get out. And then I was like, this is amazing. I can go have dinner on a Tuesday night. I don't have to get on a plane tomorrow. I can, you know, go have coffee at 10:30 in the morning. And I made up for it. So I think it was probably, you know, just like, wait, it's not just about hard work.
Okay.
You know?
Well, I mean, a lot of times people overwork in order not to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. It serves that purpose. It keeps you numb to the way you're feeling.
100%. Yep. And I think, yeah, I'm sure it probably was some of that I didn't even realize.
Was there feelings that came up that you were surprised by when you gave yourself a bit of time?
Just happiness, to be honest.
So not necessarily negative feelings or painful feelings, maybe not negative.
No, I think because then I made myself busy with having babies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know.
So you didn't stop really working hard.
Yes, I did.
You just changed it up a bit.
I did, yes. The hours were a little different.
Yeah.
I think, because I stopped working when I was pregnant with my firstborn. And then, you know, it was back-to-back two babies, 14 months apart.
Wow.
And so I guess I probably didn't stop to really think about that. And so I think it was probably, you know, again, later on in life where you're like, okay, let's examine my life and what's happening here at home. And that's when I really kind of started to do the work with you and, you know, go to some amazing retreats and, you know, just try to get present and grounded and do what I needed to do to move forward in a positive way.
So it sounds like you have transitioned out of that life.
Who knows? I mean,
I know you're a very responsible woman.
Yeah.
But I do understand, or at least I've observed that you take nice vacations.
I do.
Anyway.
Incredible vacations. Yeah. But again, this, and then too, so after I had my kids, it was probably 5-6 years ago. Like I consulted for a lot of companies and it was probably just 5 or 6 years ago that I stopped feeling guilty about working.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, I'm not at the retirement age yet, but I'm not that far behind it. But it took me a long time to not feel guilty about not working and my husband being the only one really bringing money in.
Okay.
And that took a long time. And it, which is also funny because my husband could care less. You know, you would think that I would have been like, oh, great. Okay. My work here is with the kids and, uh-huh. you know, you go do that. But I still, there was always this gnawing thing inside of me like, oh God, I should, you know, I'm able, I should be contributing. And finally, I don't know. I think just after not contributing for a while, I was like, you know what? This is working out just fine.
So. Well, you know what? He is one of the most remarkable men professionally that I've ever met because he makes it appear as though he doesn't work very hard, but he's incredibly successful.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's, well, I think he's not driven by money, mm-hmm. which is, you know, if you can detach from that, yeah. I think that goes far. And he's smart in learning to really balance life and work. And he's chosen a career where he has a lot of freedom and, mm-hmm. you know, he works hard and does it for the right reasons when he is working. And when he's not, he is off. He's gone skiing for 10 days right now. So, uh-huh. you know,
yeah.
he's learned how to do it right. But I think, I credit him with really helping me with that.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, kind of back to what we were saying just about, you know, my sort of austere household is I also, you know, kind of this lie I told myself was that creativity was a waste of time.
Oh, okay.
And it's, you know, back to like just work, 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 work. That's what it's about. And so in my household, there was no music. There was no art. I mean, I think we had that, you know, praying Father with the Lord's Prayer above like the kitchen table that we're all smushed around, no one talking to each other. It was like our only art in our house. And I was really raised to believe that like creativity was stupid. It was just a waste. And it's, you know, it was fundamentally not helping anything, which, you know, fast
That's
forward.
That's really sad.
It is sad. It's really sad. And I didn't, when it's not part of your life, you don't even really understand what you're missing.
Yeah.
And I just was like, oh, that's stupid. That's a waste. I could be making money or, you know, doing something. And then, of course, the way it works, you know, the universe blessed me with the most creative child ever, who that's all he lives for is right. creating on a daily basis.
Uh-huh.
And my husband, too. And my daughter, she's really into music. And, you know, I'll just be like, how do you even know the words to all these songs? But it's exactly what I needed to sort of learn that, like, to create, you know, the arts and creativity, it's a beautiful thing. It is what is the magic potion of life.
Right.
And it's not just about, you know, working and
yep.
doing that whole thing. So that's been really nice.
Very good.
Yeah. I'm looking at my notes because I haven't learned that, but I don't need to take notes on everything. The other thing too is I think because I felt like I was not seen when I was growing up is I really felt like I needed to live up to someone's expectations, whether it ended up being school is where I really kind of shunned my light because I wasn't seeing it. I wasn't getting it at home. But I, you know, every kid craves just to be seen. Every person
sure.
craves to be seen.
Absolutely.
And so I think that I kind of went overboard in school because there I was seen and I knew that I mattered and I made a difference. And, you know, so I just spent my youth just trying to be seen by anyone, whether it was teachers or bosses or boyfriends or friends, I need to be seen by someone because my parents weren't doing it. And, you know, I think that that's a pretty common perception for people that aren't seen is they're going to figure out a way to be seen by
yeah.
someone. And I definitely did that.
So how do you feel when you think about that notion that you were so in need of attention and just some acknowledgement that it took over your life in some ways? That just seems really sad to me.
Yeah, but I think when you're in it, you don't even really understand it.
Okay. So you weren't aware of the pain when you were going through it.
I wasn't really aware of the pain. Again, I think it was just, I just need to keep moving forward. And I don't think I really opened up until I got, you know, into my, you know, last 10, 15 years. I was like, this wasn't right, what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's caused some hardship in my life. And I've had to sort of relearn behaviors in terms of like, I don't have to take care of everything. I don't have to be so hard. I don't have to just really, I can be a little more soft. I don't have to talk so loud. I don't have to scream if I'm not being heard. But it is a work in progress where it's so easy to fall back into those behaviors. And it's just trying to take a pause and be like, okay, why am I screaming? You know, why am I doing this? Who am I doing this for? Why am I managing this? And sometimes I can sort it out. Sometimes I'm still back in like, oh no, I'm like 10, trying to get someone's approval.
Right.
And I continue to work on it. You know, and I think just that kind of goes hand in hand with, I always felt like I needed to put up a front. And so if I appeared just, you know, hard or not needing someone, or I had it all taken care of by myself, then I wouldn't need anyone and people wouldn't think that I needed anyone. And the reality was like, no, I needed everyone. I needed my parents.
Yeah.
And, but I just put up that front. And so I lied to myself and I was like, no, you don't need anyone. You've got this, you know, no one's paying attention anyway. You've got this.
So you really went against your natural need for connection and,
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's a hard shell and like, that's who wants that?
Yeah.
You know?
So do you feel like you've been able to surrender to some of your needs now?
I still think I have work to do.
Yeah.
Is
it a goal?
I don't, it is something that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But am I like, okay, I need to surrender to all this. It's not like on my post-it board or anything.
Oh, okay.
But I'm very well aware of it. And I'm doing a better job at when a behavior will come up. I will take a pause and be like, okay, why am I doing that? Why am I reacting like that? And sometimes it's, I can do it and like curtail the situation. And sometimes it's too late. Sometimes I've just, you know, managed my son's school schedule and, you know, without letting him speak. And, and then I'll go back and think about it. And then I'll either, you know, go back and have a conversation with him around it and apologize. Or sometimes it just kind of figures itself out. But I think for me, it's really what's helped is again, the work and just trying to be quiet and trying to be present and trying to hear the whisperings of why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Okay. Because, I mean, to me, we are the most dependent species on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
It's our nature to need other people and to rely on them in order to be safe because we're not predators, even though we act like we are.
Yeah.
That's a compensation for the, you know, for the vulnerability.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if it's, you know, when I talk about surrender, it's not like hands up surrender.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just more the idea that you don't want to live without the people that you love and you want to be as close to them as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen it a lot with my girlfriends where in the past it was kind of like, I was the one dispensing advice. I was the one taking care of them. I was the one they would call when they had, you know, questions or concerns. And now I've been a lot more open with them.
Oh, okay.
And I'm just like, this is kicking my ass or, you know, oh my God, this, my husband's doing this or my son's doing this and my life is not perfect. And, God, you know, help me out with this.
Yeah.
That's been, That's been really helpful. And just really being able to say that I'm sorry, or being able to just open up a little bit more. And this is a dynamic that my husband and I work on because it's probably what, you know, drew us together is I sort of manage and he sort of like, he's like, okay, fine, manage.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it worked well when we were just not conscious of it. And now that we're conscious of it, we're navigating how to make it better for both of us.
Okay. That's a good thing.
Yeah. 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 Feels good. And, you know, kids will, for me anyway, like kids will change everything. You have to be vulnerable. Well, you don't, because most people aren't, or my parents weren't at least, but I don't know. I feel like it's nice to be vulnerable with your kids, and it's nice for them to see that there are cracks, and that just because you're the parent doesn't mean that you're perfect and that you know everything. And I've been able to do that with my kids.
Well, by the time they become teenagers, whether you're able to do it or not, they're going to look at you sort of, you know, sideways.
Yeah.
Because you're no longer the supreme being that they thought you were.
That's true.
I remember the day that I looked at my kids and they looked at me like I was an idiot on legs. And I thought, okay, it's happened. They're awake now. Mm-hmm. They realize that, you know, all of this, whatever that they assigned to me was not so much.
Yeah. No, they're amazing.
And now they just make fun of me constantly. So
that's my role. True love, right?
Yeah. I become the butt of all the jokes.
Yeah. It's always the dad's role, never the mom's. What do you think that is?
Oh, I don't think that my wife and I have the same sense of humor at all. I think she would be offended by the way that they make fun of me. If they made fun of her in the same way, it just wouldn't work. I don't make fun of her either.
Oh, well.
Mostly. I just make fun of me.
It's probably safe.
It's better that way.
Yeah, very safe. Yeah.
So are there other lies that you can think of that might be important? Because I do have a question about one that you haven't mentioned yet. I don't know if it applies to you, but it is fairly universal.
I guess... also kind of going hand in hand with, you know, trying to rise to the top. I think that a lot of people have this feeling that if they are successful professionally in life, then everything is going to be great. And that is not the case. And yeah. I was not fulfilled. And we touched on it a little bit earlier. But I think when there's a hole inside and you don't know what to fill it with, and, you know, when you're in your 30s and the professional life is the easiest way to do that, or maybe like a better way than drugs and alcohol or other addictions, you think that once you do that, you're going to feel great. And honestly, like, unless you're doing meaningful work, who cares?
Right.
So I learned that not a little too late, but I learned it the hard way by spending, you know, 17 years working my ass off and then getting to the top. And I was like, ugh, whatever.
Not so good.
No, let's go to, you know, dinner on Tuesday and Starbucks at 10:30 tomorrow morning. Like, this isn't so great.
Yeah.
You know? And again, it's just like you learn it. It's about the meaningful work. And that's what I'm trying to do forward in my life. Okay. Yeah, more fulfillment.
I've asked my wife on occasion what it's like we're in our late 60s now. And what she's told me over and over again is that by the time you get to be like 45 maybe or so as a woman, that you become invisible. At least that's what she's told me. Mm-hmm. That my wife has very striking hair. So people always comment upon her hair, but I don't think that if she had the hair that she does, that she would get the kind of attention that, you know, that you would assume that just everybody would get. But she said somehow women become invisible at a certain point in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's something that you've experienced. Certainly physically, it can be part of the deal.
Yeah. I mean, it changes for sure.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I guess so. I don't feel invisible.
Okay, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't feel invisible. I know physically I've changed, and you know, I go to a workout class where I'm definitely one of the older ones in there, and there's just these beautiful young women in, you know, incredible shape and incredible like little outfits that is not going to look good. It's not going to look good on me. And, but it's funny because I don't feel like I am any older, though I am.
Okay.
And I don't feel invisible, but I mean, the reality is like, yeah, things have changed. I don't look the same. But again, I'm like, you know what? I'm just doing the best that I can. Right. And to be honest, sometimes like I don't know, maybe it was sort of the Midwest upbringing, but like I didn't like male attention like that. Meaning, I didn't like, if you put me in a parade, I'd like just cry. Like I didn't like knowing that someone was looking at me. I feel, I don't know. I don't feel invisible, but you know what? I'm not the hot potato in town. You know, I'm just the sweet potato.
Well, I mean, that brings up a question. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but as a man, I was not raised, you know, to be really self-conscious about the way I look, right? I've bought lots of pairs of pants in the course of my life, but I've never looked at what my butt looks like in my pants. I mean, I've never turned around and thought, and now I don't even have a butt anymore, but that's the case for all old men. But I've been told over and over again by women from very early age. And my daughter used to say to me all the time, how come the only thing that anybody ever comments about me is how I look? Because she was a gorgeous, absolutely stunning little kid.
Yeah.
And so people would look at her and they want to touch her, and you know, as a baby. And she got tons of attention for how pretty she was.
Yeah.
And I think she liked, you know, how could you not like being pretty? You get a lot of attention. But she would often say, is there, you know, is there anything else about me that matters?
Yeah.
Especially when she was an adolescent.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if you have told yourself lies about your physical body, like some women do, that you're not attractive enough, you're not this enough, you wish you were more of that. I don't know if that's something that you're plagued with, but I know lots of women, super self-conscious. And if you think about the cosmetic industry as an example, you know, somebody told me that works in a dermatologist's office, that when they have sales on, you know, filler and whatever the other stuff is that I don't know about, that the doctors didn't even show up on the sale days, and they sell like $100,000 worth of product in one day. I'm thinking, that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all women buying, mostly women. There's a few men, but mostly it's women buying cosmetic types of treatments to make themselves look younger. And again, I don't know whether this is something that's bugged you over the course of time and how you live with your physical you know, being, because I just, most men are just not subject to that kind of scrutiny.
I mean, for sure women are, and for sure I have been.
So does this qualify as a lie that you've told yourself?
Well, it depends, because I guess if the lie is you're not really pretty and I wasn't really pretty, it wouldn't be a lie. But I think the lie is that, maybe the lie is like, just looking natural is okay. And I don't think that. Like, I put on makeup, I fix my hair, I try to look my best when I feel like it. So I guess the lie is that, yeah, I don't look good in my natural state.
Right.
And I need to do all this other stuff to make myself feel better.
Uh-huh.
But it makes me feel better. So is that a bad lie?
Well, I'm not suggesting that all of the lies that we tell ourselves are destructive. I'm just wondering, because I've yet to meet a woman that is not concerned about their appearance.
Yeah.
And, most of the men I know, we just make fun of each other for being...
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. For just being, whatever.
Yeah. And especially like because I was given attention because of the way I looked and I wasn't getting it, anywhere else, it probably was a little double impact for me.
Okay.
That...
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Just meaning like because I wasn't, no one saw me for just being who I was. My parents weren't even looking at me,
Right.
And then
right.
I wasn't unattractive in school. And, I know I'm a reasonably attractive person.
Uh-huh.
So I think that maybe that sort of enhanced that because now I'm getting attention for, being attractive. But I have to say, I'll always remember this. I hate saying I was popular, but that's the truth. I was popular.
Why do you hate saying that?
It just sounds like, but I had a friend who was much prettier than I was. And, but we would share boyfriends and they would go out with her because she was so pretty, but they would go out with me because I was a great person to talk to.
Uh-huh.
And they liked my personality better.
Right.
So I was always like, it's not so bad that I wasn't the prettiest because I had to learn how to carry a conversation and be engaging. And, I had this boyfriend in college and he was dating this girl and she was like, I don't know how Justine gets all this way. She's not even that pretty. And so I've never thought that I was that pretty, but I know I'm not a dog.
Okay.
So... I do, a little enhancement around that.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't bother me.
Okay, so it's not a source of anxiety or self-doubt or a feeling like if I don't do this, then I'm not good enough or that I'm not attractive enough, that sort of thing?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I definitely like doing it. So I don't know, maybe is that deep in there, but if I let myself go, I think I'd feel like shit. Like, uh-huh. I don't want to be like, the overweight one with the bad hair and uh-huh. sitting in the corner with the bad yeah. outfit on. Like that's just not uh-huh. who I am. So
well, I remember having, I'm sorry, am I interrupting?
No.
I was having cancer removed from my nose at the dermatologist's office and, it was a woman that was doing the surgery, and she said to me, I'm going to do my best not to leave a scar, and it won't be noticeable. And I said to her, I don't care. Because if you saw my body, I have like the biggest scars anybody that could ever have.
Yeah.
All the way from the bottom of my spine to the top, both sides of my neck.
Yeah.
I got scars everywhere, like big giant ones. And I figured, one more, who cares?
Right.
And when I said that to her, she looked at me like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You're supposed to care.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I really don't. If you saw my body, you would see that I'm like I got more scars than anybody. And she said, well, I'm not going to add one to that. She actually got mad at me for,
that's so funny.
Telling her that I didn't really care that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, then when I told her what I did for a living, the room went silent.
She's like, I'm not talking anymore.
They all got super uncomfortable because you can't tell people you're a psychologist without them getting really uncomfortable.
Or start talking a mile a minute and telling you all their problems.
Right? No, that's not what happened.
Oh, God.
They had a drape over my face. And they said, what do you do for a living? And I said, I can't tell you.
You'll cut
and she
off my
said,
nose.
Why? And I said, because you'll get uncomfortable.
Oh, that's no, so
I
funny. Won't.
And I told her, and the room went silent. She and her assistant didn't say a word.
Oh, my God.
And I said, this happens all the time. I can't see you. You have a drape over my face. Don't worry. I'm not trying to figure out what's wrong with you.
Funny.
And they sort of chuckled. But that was really the end of friendly conversation.
Wow.
Because I think
start telling you all my problems.
Well, but that's very unusual. Most people shy away because they figure that I'm going to figure out the lies they tell themselves
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and how they see themselves from the perspective of shame
yeah.
and not being good enough. And most people have secrets and they'd prefer to keep their secrets a secret. That's yeah. why they're secrets.
Yeah.
And most of those secrets have to do with how we feel about ourselves
yeah.
and how much shame we carry and so on and so forth. I mean, and that brings up a question. Do you feel like you've been able to deal with some of the shame that was instilled in you by the neglect that you suffered as a kid, because I don't think it was overt abuse. I think it was more neglect than anything.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny, Dana. I feel like I should be more screwed up than I am. And I had it rough, but I've never had this sort of self-doubt or I'm not good enough. I mean, I've definitely had my lies or my workarounds, but I've never suffered from, feeling bad about myself or not feeling good enough. Like, I don't know. And maybe that's part of like I said, you make it work in your favor, where when you're only depending on yourself,
yeah.
I was like, I'm all right. I'm good enough. And I really do feel like that. And I think I got blessed with understanding life. And I've always done this, I think, from a position of gratitude. And I just wake up and I'm like, I have the best effing life.
Okay.
And I really believe that. And even if, I don't know, my kids are driving me crazy or my husband's like, I just have the best life. And I feel like just believing that makes everything okay.
And how did you get to a place where you were able to recognize, despite whatever trials and tribulations that you've had to deal with, how'd you hold on to that gratitude, or how did you develop that attitude? Because I think it's really important. Most of the people that I talk to that lie to themselves, me included, certainly didn't feel very good about myself at all.
I don't know, honestly. I mean, I think I've always had it, even when my, family situation was like crazy. I think one, I was recognized by teachers and friends. And again, if it wasn't for my great grandmother and my grandmother who made sure that we were seen and loved, I'd probably be in jail right now.
Oh, okay.
So I think I can attribute everything in my life that is good goes back to them. Thank God.
So you got enough love from them to fill you up in ways that you were not being filled up by your parents.
Yeah. I mean, they say every kid just needs one, right? And if you don't have one, you're really screwed. And I had, I had two plus. I mean, I had an aunt that was amazing too. But I don't think if it wasn't for them, my life would be a shit show.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because when you said, I got recognized by the people, my grandmother, great grandma, and they love me. I got recognized for being a shit, being a troublemaker.
Yeah.
And I think that if you could have interviewed any of my teachers or any of my friends, well, maybe not my friends' parents, because I was able to fool them.
Yeah.
Into thinking that I was the angel in the crowd, even though I was the instigator. But that was because I fooled them.
Yeah.
But I just think that the things that happened or didn't happen left me like really rebellious and wanting to hurt back, if that makes sense. And so I was shit. I mean, I felt so sorry for my little brother. I've talked about this before. Every class he ever went into, they would always ask him, because my last name is really not that popular, please tell me that you don't have an older brother and sister.
Right.
Because immediately
they
were just assuming that he was going to be a shit also.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is that he was super eager to please and a really sweet guy.
He had to. It was the opposite of you.
Well, because he watched his brother and sister be the opposite and saw that they can get anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he, he's just a kind-hearted guy in that way and very eager to please.
Aww.
So I think he redeemed the name, but certainly not the elder sibling, that's for sure.
Well, and I think, I suffer from what a lot of women do, and that's just people-pleasing. And you learn that at an early age, and I did that. And
so was that something you saw in your family, or was that just something that you assumed would get you the approval and positive attention from other people?
I think it would just get me the positive attention from others. You know, I had an older brother who was probably like you, who was super rebellious. And again, like, I'd walk into the classroom, they're like, oh my God, you're his sister?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah.
So it was the opposite.
Yeah.
And so I just saw what he was doing and, you know, how everything was so hard for him. And there were just constant battles between he and my dad. And so I did the opposite. I just put my nose down and I did all the things I thought I was supposed to do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it's like that I never got recognition from my parents about, oh, she's good in school or,
Never gave you any sort of anything.
This is so funny. It's the only thing. And I told my dad this the other day, the only thing when I graduated high school and I was like captain of cheerleading and I had almost, you know, all A's and B's and I did all the stuff that you think you're supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
And I was on this board and vice president, like, nah, 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 nah. And on the last day of school, they gave awards for how many days that you missed in your 4 years of high school.
Oh.
And because I was so desperate to get out of my house, I went to school every day. And in 4 years of high school, I think I only missed 5 days. And so I got an award. And that,
come on,
is what my dad was, the only thing that he's ever said about, wow, that I can't believe you did that. That's pretty amazing. Again, going back to like, we fucking show up for the hard work. But never like, I mean, if I said to my dad now, I'm like, Dad, did you know that I was like student body president? He'd have no idea. Like,
really?
Literally no idea. No.
Well, actually, that doesn't surprise me. Although, but you would think if you had a kid that was just like a superstar, or at least attempting to, you know, be a good kid and really be successful, that would please you in some way.
He was checked out with his own family. Oh, I mean, had, you know, three siblings that were younger and much younger. And, you know, so we kind of glossed over this point, but like I lived with my waitress mom until I was 11. And then one weekend he picked me up at a sleepover in, you know, August. And all of a sudden I went to live with him.
Oh.
So at 11, I went to live with my dad and my stepmom and their little family. And they had, I think my stepbrothers are like 5 and 3, and my stepmom was pregnant with her third. So my brother and I kind of got dumped into that overnight when I was 11 and he was 13, you know, wonderful, wonderful ages to switch into a new family that is completely different than your family. And so I just think he was working and, you know, detached emotionally. And so I think he was just trying to juggle everything that was on his plate.
And was your stepmom resentful that all of a sudden she had these other kids to take care of?
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Oh, well, I'm asking you.
I'm sure she wasn't thrilled.
Okay.
I'm sure she had no say in the matter. And, you know, I think she had her own struggles and, you know, trying to raise her own three kids. And then you got this hellion son and then this daughter coming in. And, you know, again, it was, she didn't have a say and she did the best that she could. And she was great with my kids. But, you know, there were some tough years that people just kind of gloss over.
What happened to your little sister?
So when I was 11 and that fateful sleepover when I went to my dad's, my little sister went and lived with my grandmother for a while. And then my mom had moved to Florida that weekend. And then, I don't know, a year later or whatever, then my sister, she went out there to live with her. So my younger sister ended up growing up with my mother in Florida while my brother and I lived in Iowa with my dad.
Oh, okay.
So I think she chose the one who was like the easiest to deal with. Yeah. She was little and she was malleable and she didn't smoke pot at 11 or something. So it worked. Okay.
Yeah. So that turned out okay.
Oh God. Well, no.
No?
No. I mean, my sister is a lovely human being, but man, the trauma that my mom instilled in her life, which has never really been rectified, is sad. And, you know, again, like she got a pass because she died.
Oh,
and
okay.
What are you going to do? And she's gone. And my sister's done an incredible job with how she was left out to dry by my mom. Like, an incredible job. She's a nurse. She's kind. She's has her own family, but she's, you know, there's a lot of sadness in there too that she probably will never really understand how to deal with.
And what about your brother?
Oh my God, my brother, my sweet brother. He had it the most rough, I think, because I think he was older. He was the rebellious one. He was a really sensitive, creative kid that just clashed with my dad, who was the exact opposite.
Oh, okay.
And he's doing his own work and has made incredible strides in the last couple of years, but he's had a tough road. And, you know, I just, after my family, like, it's my brother and I will make sure that he's okay. Cause again, going back to, I have to take care of everyone,
but that part's still part of your life.
Yeah. And it feels okay. You know, if someone needs your help and you love and care about them, you help them.
Okay.
And,
so your heart goes out to your brother.
Oh
especially.
My God. You know it. Yeah. Yeah. More so than anyone.
Does he recognize how amazingly well you've done considering what you went through?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he's, he every year for my birthday, he writes me like a 2-page letter and just, he's very, very proud of me. And he acknowledges how much I've helped him. And he has a lot of respect for how I've raised my kids. And he definitely has. And it's really, you know, it's really nice. And
yeah.
It's sweet. He's.
I did have the pleasure of meeting him. He's a lovely guy.
He's the sweetest.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just glad that he kind of got things on track before he didn't. And like his, again, like if I was going to be in jail, he would have been in like, you know, the electric chair for God knows what, because we were just up to no good at a really young age because we could.
Yeah. So now that you've had the chance to kind of think about how you have deceived yourself, not through any fault of your own, obviously, what would you suggest that men or women do in the face of knowing how destructive that these lies can be and how much they can impact the way that you actually see yourself?
Well, I really think the first thing you have to do is you really need to do what I did and get out a pen and a piece of paper and be like, what are the lies that I'm telling myself? And write them down and give it some thought, because we've been telling ourselves these lies for so long, and you'll be surprised at how many there are. And once I think you can recognize them, then you can start to unravel them. And I think that we've, for the most part, I don't know too many people that have had perfect childhoods.
Oh, that's for sure.
And they've been hurt in one way or the other. And I think it really goes back to doing the deep work. And I think I wish there was less stigma around therapy and healing. Yeah. I mean, I know here where we live, it's not as bad, but you know, I think about my family all the time, my siblings and, you know, extended family. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like your life doesn't have to be like this. You can, you know, you can open up, you can talk to someone. And so I think that just people being aware that there are these lies and how they have affected you, and then doing the work, and that's just through talk therapy or whatever, I think is really important, because you've been telling yourselves them so long that you don't always see them.
Right.
And, you know, you don't even recognize what they're about. Like, you know, me yelling at my husband or something. It's like, no, I'm yelling because I feel like I'm not in control and I'm used to being in control because that's how I was raised. And this is my deal, not his deal.
Right.
You know, and you have to unravel it all. And it takes hard work.
Indeed.
But my God, like, we have one life and we're going to get to the end and we're like, well, this sucked, or I, you know, I never really dealt with this. Like, why would anyone do that? And it's, you know, yeah, it's hard. And then it's just wide open. And then you get kicked back to the curb a little bit, and then you've got to do some more work. And it's just like, it's just a healing process that I think the earlier that you can start, the better. And, we have one life, and I always, I'm like, okay, it's like the deathbed question. Like, is how do I want to be remembered? What am I going to think about when I'm on my deathbed? And like, can I try to deal with that now? So I don't know. There's just people that want to help, and there's ways to do it. And opening your heart and being vulnerable is something that I learned recently, and it's changed my life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being so candid and open about all of this stuff. I know when I first asked you, as you said, I'm not sure I want to do that.
Yeah.
But you did a beautiful job, and it's, you know, it's, your story is amazing.
Oh, well, thank you.
So I really appreciate it. And I think that, that it'll be quite helpful for people to listen to this episode and really understand that it's so important for us to be willing to look at ourselves in the mirror.
I hope so. I think I told you I'm starting these workshops that are for women, and it's sort of about this, where it's, you know, bringing women together that are feeling like they're stuck, or they're not seen, or they, you know, want to go to the next step, or they're feeling apathetic. And it's really just through different practices and conversations around healing our hearts and being present and what we want next in life, that I am facilitating for women. And I know this is why I was put on this planet, is to do this work. And I just, you know, if I can do it for myself and I can help other people, it's what I want.
So if there are women that are interested in attending your workshop, how do they reach out to you? How do they get a hold of you?
So they can go on my website, which is justinehamilton.com, or they can find me on Instagram, Coach Justine Hamilton, and it's called the 4-Day Forward. And we're doing one in May, and we're doing one in October. And the first one in May is during the week from 9 to 2, and then the one in October is for women that can't get away and need to come on a weekend. So they can find me that way. They can reach out to me either way, and I would love to talk through any questions they have or tell them more about it, but it's going to be great. I'm really excited.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm sure I'll see you again soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Dana.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.